From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A three-day hearing on Israel's growing West Bank barrier began today at the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The Israeli government calls the imposing miles of barbed wire, towering walls, and watchtowers an urgent matter of security, a vital protection against terrorist attacks like yesterday's bus bombing in Jerusalem that killed 8 and wounded more than 50. Palestinians say the barrier threatens the viability of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and violates fundamental human rights. The Palestinian side will testify to the impact of the barrier on everyday citizens, of farmers cut off from their fields and students cut off from schools. Israeli groups are sending the wreckage of a bombed-out bus and their own school children, each carrying a picture of a person killed in Palestinian attacks. Tonight on Point, judging Israel's barrier and its implications for Middle East peace and security. We begin tonight in Jerusalem, where Israelis are still reeling from yesterday's suicide bombing that killed 8 and wounded more than 50. John Ward Anderson is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him to describe the damage done by the bombing.
The main damage may have been to the Palestinians' case against the fence in The Hague, but here the physical damage and the tragedy of it was 8 Israelis died, the suicide bomber himself died, and about 50 Israelis, possibly as many as 60, were also injured.
And you say the main damage may be to the Palestinians' complaints against the security barrier. What do you mean?
This could not have come at a worse time for the Palestinians trying to make their case and argue their case in The Hague that the fence that's going up around the West Bank should not be built. For the Israelis, they take a look at the suicide bombing that occurred and say that this is all the evidence we need of why we have to have a fence surrounding the West Bank and to separate ourselves from the Palestinians, because they're sending over suicide bomber after suicide bomber after suicide bomber. And any country, they believe, would direct a fence like this. And, you know, in a way, they have a point. If you take a look at the southern border of the United States with Mexico, there are fences, there are walls, there's electronic surveillance equipment all along there. And Mexico isn't sending over suicide bombers, they're just sending over migrant workers. The difference, of course, is that the Israeli fence is not going up along the border between the West Bank and Israel. It's sometimes just deep into the West Bank, 2 miles, 3 miles. It could, in the end, jut as far as 13 miles into the West Bank. And if projections are accurate, it could effectively close off 40 to 50% of the West Bank to the Palestinians. So their point is that it's a land grab and that it's therefore illegal. Many of them say if Israel were in fact building the fence along the border with the West Bank, that they wouldn't have a problem with it.
John, remind us of the basics here. How much of this 450-mile planned fence and wall and barrier complex is now complete?
About 110 miles are complete, and about another 35 miles more than that are under construction right now. The exact contours of the fence line are not known yet. It's a bit of a secret that the Israeli military is keeping. They sort of show up in an area with their bulldozers and start wrecking the fence. So the exact fence line is not known quite yet.
And why does the barrier extend so deeply at points into the West Bank occupied territory of the Palestinians?
Well, it's swooping in basically to surround Jewish settlements that are in the West Bank. There are very, very large concentrations of Jewish settlers, sometimes very, very deep in the West Bank. There's a settlement, for instance, called Ariel, which is almost in the center of the West Bank. Again, the fence line is not known, but some people are arguing strenuously that the fence needs to go in. The mayor of Ariel argues that, you know, we have the right of any Israeli citizen to be protected from suicide bombers, and therefore the fence ought to come in and surround us, and if it doesn't, I'm going to file a lawsuit against Ariel Sharon. And so what happens here is that the fence is going deep inside the West Bank to try and surround Jewish settlements there and protect the citizens.
What are Israeli security people saying? If the fence is completed as planned, how large a barrier against terrorism would this be?
The Israelis argued that a fence that was built years ago around Gaza has in fact kept Palestinian suicide bombers from infiltrating into Israel. They say that no Palestinian, and they're right, no Palestinian suicide bombers have infiltrated from Gaza into Israel proper to commit a suicide bombing. And they argue that in fact if you built a fence around the West Bank that you could expect similar results. The Palestinians say, and many Israelis by the way agree, that the West Bank is a different sort of creature. It's just so big and so porous progress that they expect to build a lot of breaks and a lot of doors in the fence line for people to pass back and forth, and that there's no way you're going to be able to prevent a dedicated suicide bomber who wants to get into Israel from getting inside.
Paint the picture, then, of the barrier from the Palestinian side. How does it impinge upon life for Palestinians in the West Bank?
Well, it really does cut through in many places, cut right through towns, and it separates, in many instances, families, sons and daughters from their parents, for instance. Oftentimes, they're on different side of the fence, or in some cases, it's a 25-foot-high wall. In many urban areas in particular, students are now separated from their schools and are unable to cross the line to go to school. Many people are separated from their fields. Many of the farmers can't get to their olive groves or to their orange groves in order to harvest and care for their agriculture. Other Palestinians are separated from their other types of jobs. It really is cutting through the very lives of many Palestinians.
What exactly is the International Court of Justice taking up then in The Hague?
They're being asked to rule effectively on whether or not defense is legal. Israel is boycotting the oral arguments. They've submitted a 130-page or 135-page written brief. And many other countries are also skipping oral presentations and arguing that the Court of Justice, the World Court, doesn't really belong in this issue and that there are political ways of dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Specifically, especially the United States argues that the United Nations is already involved in, as one of the partners in the so-called roadmap, and that that's the way you should be resolving disputes between Israelis and Palestinians. The Palestinians, on the other hand, say that this is a gross violation of their rights, that this is a blatant land grab, an attempt to establish de facto borders and take away huge swaths of the West Bank from them, and that it ought to be declared illegal, and that if it is, there ought to be South African-style sanctions imposed on Israel.
If the International Court of Justice comes to that conclusion, and that would be, we're told, a year or more from now, are material consequences expected, or will it just be there as a judicial ruling without real consequence?
Well, I think the latter is probably the case. I mean, if they take it back to the United Nations and throw it down on the Security Council table, whatever happens would probably be vetoed by the United States. The question is whether or not something would percolate up from more grassroots-style organizations like what happened with South Africa. The boycott and the economic sanctions in South Africa got a lot of their oomph from private organizations. And I think what you might see is the Palestinians trying a heavy PR campaign to try and persuade people around the world to implement that kind of a sanctions program.
In the meantime, mourning goes on for the fresh dead in Israel from the suicide bombing yesterday. And, John, does the construction of the fence continue as the court considers the case?
Yes. You know, in fact, the prospects of the court hearing in The Hague has prompted Israel to actually change the barrier in certain areas to try and make it less intrusive in Palestinian lives. So already the court hearing has had a beneficial impact. But there's no doubt about it. The bombing yesterday, I was talking to the mayor of Jerusalem, and he said, you know, once again, this bombing shows that we have to expedite the construction of the fence, especially around Jerusalem.
John Ward Anderson, thank you for joining us.
Tom, thank you.
John Ward Anderson is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Jerusalem. We are talking tonight about Israel's West Bank barrier and its implications for peace and security in the Middle East. Can the barrier work for both Israelis and Palestinians? Is it a solution? Is it a land grab? What should the International Court of Justice decide here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Makovsky, Senior Fellow and Director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His article in the March-April issue of Foreign Affairs magazine is How to Build a Fence. Good evening and welcome, David Makovsky.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also joining us tonight from Washington is Saeed Erekat, Washington correspondent and political analyst for the Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds. Good evening and welcome, Saeed Erekat.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us.
And hello, David.
Hi, Saeed.
David Makovsky, to you first, if I may. You have written that build this wall, this fence, this barrier right, and it's good. Build it wrong, and it's bad. What's the difference, and what's actually happening? Do you see a good barrier going up or a bad barrier?
I think right now it's a good barrier. Obviously, the best would be if there was a partnership of Israelis and Palestinians, and you wouldn't need a barrier at all. But if there was no terror, there'd be no fence. This fence is a result of 3 years of relentless suicide bombing, 280 attempts, according to IDF records of infiltrations from the West Bank into Israel. You can imagine, if you had that in the Boston area, where 135 of those times they got through, how people there would react. But I think apart from the issue of self-defense, this fence is a buffer fence that makes it safe for Israel to leave most of the West Bank, as opposed to an encirclement fence that the PLO has claimed that Israel wants to build, which would encircle the Palestinians from all sides. And that, I think, would be a bad fence and would mean that Israel would stay in the West Bank. But that's the fence that is not being built. The fence that is being built, and I disagree with your correspondent, Mr. Anderson, because all he has to do is look on the Internet site of the Israeli Ministry of Defense.
You disagree with him when he says that it could ultimately take 40 to 50% of the West Bank, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, well, right now, the MOD has announced what fence they're building, and the fence is, and the United Nations, that I don't think people think has overly been overly sympathetic to Israel, to put it mildly, agree. This is a barrier of 14.5% of the West Bank, adjacent to what's known as the Green Line, the pre-1967.
That is the barrier as currently
right.
plotted, you're saying, exactly. would take almost 15%, not 50, of
right.
the West Bank.
Exactly. And the net effect is also you should realize where, I mean, I spent months tabulating the population figures based on the Palestinian Authority census and the mathematical formula to make sure it's up to date. 638 Palestinian villages and 128 Jewish settlements. And the
What about them? They're on the west side of the fence.
Right.
They're...
In other words, what you've got is a situation, and the 94 to 99% of the West Bank Palestinians live to the east of the fence, which is 85% of the West Bank. And the Jewish settlers, 76% of them, or 170,000 people, live to the west of the fence, near the Green Line, the 1967 boundary.
Saeed Erekat, let me put it to you. Is this the kind of fence that could make good neighbors or not?
Absolutely not. I think David knows very well. I mean, you can... cut through all the stuff that is being talked about, the fence, and it's not really a fence, it's a major wall. As David knows very well, the wall goes through my village, and it's more than 8 meters high. That's about 26 feet high.
We've seen the pictures. Sometimes lots of barbed wire, sometimes very tall walls.
You know, in my case, it touches very closely. I know exactly what it has done to people of my village, my relatives, and so on, separating them. Literally, as Mr. Anderson said, families from their sons and daughters, people from going to their shops. I have a relative that now has to travel 25 kilometers to go to his shop right across the way. So the fence is really all about the land grab. You can defend it all you want, but the facts speak for themselves.
But
the fact of the matter that, once this is done, you're going to have roughly 500,000 people between in the West Bank, between the wall and the Green Line. In the Jerusalem area, close to 200,000 people. And on and on. It has already taken 18% of the water that was being supplied to the Palestinians, a commodity that is getting scarcer and scarcer. They have uprooted already for the fence more than 100, or for the wall, more than 100,000 trees, olives, and other things. So it really imposes a very, very difficult hardship. And on the moral aspect, on the moral side of this thing, the wall is not going to resolve the issue. The issue is very simple. The Palestinians are being occupied. The West Bank is occupied. Gaza is occupied. And if you really want to end the terror, which is really despicable, there's nothing more despicable and ugly than the suicide bombing. Nobody, most Palestinians do not support that. But if you really want to end this horrible situation, then you have to end the occupation. That is the obvious, and that is the big elephant in the room.
David McCuskey, we just got a few seconds before the break, but do you expect a judgment from the International Court of Justice in The Hague to affect the outcome here?
No, I agree with Mr. Anderson on that because, if it would ever go to the Security Council, I think there would be an American veto. But I really don't think that's the issue. I mean, the main issue is there hardship? And I agree with Saeed that for those people, I think his numbers are completely off, but without getting into that, there's only 11,000 people that live in that area between the West Bank and the fence, but the Green Line and the fence. But leave that aside. The point is that both sides here have a hardship. But when you get blown up, as it happened,
that's a hardship too. David McCuskey, we've got to take a break. Said Erekat, we'll be right back. We're talking about Israel's security fence. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel's security barrier and its implications for peace and security in the Middle East. You can join our conversation. Is the fence, the wall, the 450-mile eventually barrier a solution or a long-term problem? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David McCuskey, I'm sorry I had to cut you off just as you were coming to your conclusion there.
Yeah, no, I think the point here is there's hardship on both sides. And the key thing is how do you maximize Israeli security while minimizing Palestinian hardship? And this idea that, once you have a fence, it's a, quote, a land grab, and that's it, they'll set the borders forever. The fact is that if you look at all the peace agreements and withdrawals that the Israelis have done on four fronts, with the Egyptians, the Jordanians, with the Syrians, and with the Lebanese, they always were fences were moved. So we all hope that this partnership is restored. But in the meantime, the question is, do you let people keep getting blown up? And I think the core is to save lives in the meantime and avoid as many people being blown up as possible.
David McCuskey, Said Erekat, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, also from Washington, Martin Indyk, former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Israel, 95 to 97 in 2000 to 2001. He's director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Good evening and welcome, Martin Indyk.
Good evening to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. Step back with us here, Martin Indyk. How do you see the big picture here? What are the implications for Israel, for the Palestinians, for peace of the so-called security barrier?
Well, I think if you try to look at it in terms of a long-term trend, what it demonstrates is, on the one hand, that the Israeli people's desire for security above all, is leading them to demand that this fence be built. 80% of Israelis want this fence built. But what they are basically saying is they want to separate themselves from the Palestinians, that they don't want to be there anymore in the West Bank, and they want to basically live behind secure borders. And that means that as the fence goes up, it will be modified precisely as David is suggesting is already happening. It will come closer to the 67 borders. And once it's in place, I think the pressure on the Israeli government will be inexorable to actually pull back behind that fence.
So you're not concerned, as David McCuskey writes in his piece in Foreign Affairs, that there are a number of options here. And one of them is a kind of territorial expansion that does take the wall much deeper into the West Bank. He hangs this on Ariel Sharon and says, you know, it could happen, though he's saying tonight probably not. But you're not worried about that? You think that the wall, the fence, the barrier is likely to move west, not east?
That's right. And I think it is already happening. And the reason that it's happening is partly because of American pressure. The Bush administration has made it clear that it won't support a fence that snakes into the West Bank in a serious way, because a strong majority of Israelis no longer support the idea of keeping settlements deep in the West Bank. The Prime Minister himself is talking about evacuating settlements, not only in Gaza, where he's talking about evacuating almost all of them, but also the outlying settlements in the West Bank. So you have basically a trend that's moving quite quickly in Israel. And you have reflecting that trend, the Shinui Party, which is the center party, which has 15 seats in the coalition government, is insisting that the fence be moved westward. And that is a reflection of how the whole body politic is moving from the right back to the center.
So there it comes, back to the center. Martin Indyk, I guess the other question then that arises is this Israel saying, you know, a pox on you Palestinians, we're not even going to negotiate, we'll build this fence, and then you do what you want on the other side? Does it diminish the possibility of a two-state solution, of a negotiated solution, or does it raise it because it, you know, gives some sense of peace and security to Israel and makes it more willing to negotiate?
Well, it kind of does both, and it's not clear which way it's going to go. I think that you do have on both sides an element of kind of a punitive approach. Both sides are now, as a result of 3 years of this bloody violence and terrorism, measuring their own victories in the context of how miserable they can make the other side, and that's a very destructive process. And the Israelis, basically, by putting up this big wall and this long fence, are saying, yes, a pox on you, you can, you know, we don't care what happens to you, just leave us alone. On the other hand, on the Palestinian side, what you have is also a very negative development, which is the Palestinians, instead of taking responsibility for their own affairs, going back to playing the victim. And the fence barrier does this, serves a very useful purpose in that regard. So, you know, there's a lot of complaining and histrionics and exaggeration, but there's no willingness on the Palestinian side to stand up and say, let's take responsibility for ourselves. There wouldn't be a fence if there wasn't terror. Let's stop that terror. Unfortunately, we don't now have on the Palestinian side a capable, responsible, accountable Palestinian leadership that could play that role and get us back. Now, to the extent that the Israeli pressure to pull out of the West Bank creates a vacuum, there is an opportunity there. Either it gets filled by Hamas and the Islamic extremists and terrorist groups and warlords, or it's going to get filled with the help of the international community by a more responsible Palestinian leadership. And that in itself can produce a negotiating partner combined with an Israeli urge to get out of there that can hopefully produce a two-state solution.
Could. Maybe not. Ambassador Martin Indyk, Syed Erekat, David McCoskey, stand by. I want to welcome our callers in. Eric is calling from Boston. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would suggest first, as to your question, what the international court should do.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree that it should state that it does not have jurisdiction over this matter, that it is a political matter. As to the specific issue concerning the fence, I would say that the fence that Israel is building is legitimate for the reasons that David McCoskey mentioned and the last speaker mentioned.
Yes.
And I would also point to the fact that Saudi Arabia has put up a barrier between itself and Yemen, and for the very same reason that Israel is putting this fence up. I would also state that the Palestinians would have had a state if they took Barak's offer. And in addition, the Arab states have been no help. In specific terms, Lebanon created and did not integrate into their society the Palestinians and refugee camps.
So you're throwing up your hands, Eric, and saying, build the fence, build the wall, put it up, build it high.
Build it, and in addition, that I do agree that there's chaos on the other side, that is the Palestinian side, as recent articles in the Times and the Globe have indicated, but that it will not be brought to order by Israel making compromises with political leadership that has no power at its base.
Eric, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Syed Erekat, what's your response to that perspective? You know, it's widespread one.
There's plenty to respond to.
Yes, please.
First of all, you know, Martin talks about the Palestinians going back to playing the victims. The fact of the matter is that the Palestinians are the victims, and they have been victimized for a very, very long time, and brutally. It's not as though that the Palestinians get up in the morning and they commit terror and everything goes back to normal. They're also subject to incursions, very brutal incursions. The killing goes on. Many more Palestinians are killed during periods of quiet, as I'm sure Martin and David know. But beyond that, I mean, this gentleman that called in says Saudi Arabia is building a fence. Certainly, we don't want to use the Saudi example. But beyond that, Israel can build any fence, any wall it wants along the green line. But by building what they are building today, they really are rendering the two-state option as a doomed fantasy.
Because Palestinians will not accept less than, 95% of the West Bank? Is that what you're saying?
I think this is another fallacy. You see, there was no Barak offer. I think Ambassador Indyk knows that. There were Clinton points that came out later on, but the Barak offer that is so much touted as being done during the Camp David negotiations really never occurred.
There was negotiation. There was talk of less than 100%.
I'm sorry?
There was negotiation. There was talk of less than 100%. Is your point that Palestinians would never accept less than 100% of everything east of the Green Line?
Well, first of all, there was no offer by Barack. You can check that with the people that were involved.
I don't want to get stuck on that, though. But
I don't want to get stuck on that either. I mean, we're talking about the wall. The wall, if Israel wants to erect the wall, let it erect the wall. If they want to do what Mexico did, let them do what Mexico did. But do it on the green line. Don't do it to preempt the prospect for a two-state solution. It is either that or... Let's face it, what you have today is a one state, where half the population is being oppressed and the other half is being protected and so on. So that's what you're going to end up with. These are the matters of fact. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
Ellen is calling from Boston. Ellen, welcome. You're on the air.
I'm very familiar with the conflict. I've been following it for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I wrote about it on and off during the 1980s. I visited there during the 1980s. And I just made a trip to the West Bank this past January.
And what did you see, Ellen?
What I saw by contrast with what I had experienced in the 1980s absolutely horrified me. I saw the separation barrier wall, mm-hmm. or fence, as mm-hmm. Israel likes to put it, in all of its various transmogrifications. Many feet high, parallel wires strung along poles as far as the eye could see outside a village called Rumane, which is in Jenin district. The infamous wall around Kalkilia, which we walked along in its shadow, which is 25 feet high. You really have to be there to experience it.
Did it look like a reasonable attempt to stop suicide bombings or something else?
If Israel was interested in its security, very simply, it would build a wall inside the green line on the Israeli side. This wall does not do that. These barriers do not do that. Instead, what they do is they encircle Palestinian villages and cities in nooses. They also ensnare settlements, the Jewish settlements, but... what happens with the settlements is that they are permitted easy access to and from Israel on Jewish-only bypass roads, whereas,
right.
for example, in Kalkilia, there's one gate through which people can enter and leave to get to what jobs remain to them. There's a 75% unemployment rate in Kalkilia now for a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour in the evening.
So you see the fence, the wall, and you see Palestinian suffering, not a security barrier. David Mikowski, how about it? Why? I mean, we know why, because the settlements are there, I guess, but... Is there no circumstance in which Israel could build this wall along the 67 border? Might that not create a more stable, long-term peace with the Palestinians than this jutting wall, and perhaps even more jutting wall that's under construction now?
Okay. By the way, I don't want to delve too much in the statistics, but out of the 480-mile fence,
yeah.
about 15 miles are right now is seen to be a wall. And Kalkilia, which this woman said, and I had a tour of that by the Palestinians, that wall is on the green line. And the reason why there was a wall there was because there was shootings from an apartment building that killed the child below on an Israeli highway inside Israel. But that is on the green line. But to me, I don't want to get too bogged down that even 97% of this is a fence and not a wall.
A lot
wall.
Of fence, some
it's
wall,
a
it's a barrier, right?
It's a barrier. And again, I repeat, if we had a partnership, I think if there was no terror, there'd be no fence. You have a practical problem, which you pointed out, is you've got 170,000 settlers there right now. If you're the prime minister of Israel and you're told these Palestinians want to blow up these people and you're deliberately not protecting 170,000 people, that's going to be a political problem.
Israel absorbed, a million people from Russia? Could they absorb 170,000 settlers back in?
I think it's fair to say that, Sharon is talking about getting the settlers out of Gaza now, and
yep.
I 100% agree with Martin Indyk that the logic of the fence is that all those remote settlements living east of the fence, where 85% of the West Bank is located, they're going to have to come down. probably sooner rather than later. And so instead of looking at this fence as impeding a two-state solution, as Saeed says, I think, frankly, it's the only way to facilitate a two-state solution in the absence of any partnership. It's the only way to get to partition and to disentangle these hostile, intertwined populations. So instead of looking at it as an impediment, look at it as a way, frankly, that's going to make it safe for Israel to leave most of the West Bank at a time that most Israelis believe Yasser Arafat is a terrorist, and when he exhorts his people to have 1 million martyrs be sent against Israel. So I think you have to take the full picture into account.
Saeed Erekat, let me put that to you.
If I could add one more point, sir, one more line. You also have another issue, which is an internal Palestinian debate, which is those who say, look, build the fence on the 67 lines, abandon these 220,000 settlers even before there's an agreement. They will, I think, view it, Hamas will say, we won. We have been vindicated because Israel, we blew them up in discotheques and pizza parlors on buses, and the net effect is they ran back to the 67 lines. They abandoned those 220,000 people. We can blow up as many of those people as well. So,
and if Hamas thinks that, but there's peace and separation, is that a problem?
No. If you had peace, like I keep coming back to the same point, when the partnership is restored, there will be border modifications. And those who say, oh, once you put up a fence, it will never be moved. Every single time, I mean, if anyone knew any history here looking at this, would say every time that Israel had an agreement, whether it was with Syria in 1974, a peace treaty with Egypt in 1979, when it was with...
But are you saying then that Israel would actually pull back the settlers one day?
Yes, because they moved settlers out of Yamit when they made peace with Egypt, and they moved fences on every single front. So you're telling me this is the only front they won't move it?
Saeed Erekat, how about it? Is there a pragmatic reason from the Palestinian perspective to support this and to say, yes, put it up, let's get some peace and quiet here and start negotiations?
Well, put it up, but put it up along the green line. There's a great deal of misinformation going on here. You see, the problem is not the fence and whether the fence is erected to protect Israel or Israeli security. The fact of the matter is this comes through a strategy, and the only person that really has a strategy in this regard is Ariel Sharon. And his strategy calls for the creation of a Palestinian state, but it is created on 42% of the West Bank and Gaza. His strategy cuts the Palestinian areas in the West Bank into 16 disjointed areas and so on, separated, almost besieged all the way through. So that is the problem. It's not an issue of this serving the ultimate purpose of a two-state solution. I think that the fence is all about a land grab because Israel is not going to abandon the settlers. Sharon has always worked to create facts on the ground, and he has been quite successful. If any policy is being held hostage to extremism, it's the policies of Ariel Sharon, whose policy is being held to the whims of the settlers.
Ambassador Indig,
who are becoming stronger and stronger, and you know, almost dictate Israeli policy.
Saeed Erekat, if I may, Ambassador Indig, we've just got a minute left. How do you expect that the result of this consideration at The Hague will ultimately play out? The Washington Post reporter John Ward Anderson was saying at the top of the hour, Israel could end up facing a kind of global campaign, a la the campaign against apartheid in South Africa, on the other side of a ruling that went against it here. Do you anticipate greater public pressure if this doesn't go in Israel's favor, and what do you expect?
Number one, I don't think it will go in Israel's favor. I think that the court is likely to rule in favor of the Palestinians, but I don't think it's going to have much impact, not only because it's not going to result in the Security Council move that the United States would support, but also because in many ways it's a kind of propaganda sideshow. The big thing that's coming, I believe, is Ariel Sharon's confrontation with the settlers about evacuating settlements from Gaza. And that will swamp all of this discussion about the fences, because that is truly a historical development that will have a long-lasting and, I believe, positive impact on the future of settling the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Epic for Israelis and Palestinians. I want to thank all of you, Martin Indyk, Saeed Erekat, and David Makovsky. Thank you, each and every one, for being with us tonight. After the break, a look at Ralph Nader's impact. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ralph Nader, who some Democrats believe played a spoiler's role in the 2000 election, is running again for president, this time as an independent. The 69-year-old consumer advocate made the announcement yesterday on the NBC News program Meet the Press. Today, candidate Nader made the rounds of the morning talk shows and spoke at the National Press Club. Following his speech, he responded to reporter questions. Here's an excerpt.
If you are so critical of President Bush, why are you helping him again win another term?
I don't think this is going to be viewed as an assistance to President Bush. You see, there's a whole myth that has to be overturned here. Some of you saw on NBC yesterday the description of how the Nader-LaDuc Green Party ticket allegedly cost Bush New Hampshire. What they didn't say was the exit polls showed that I got more Republican votes in New Hampshire than Democrat votes. You see, so they've got to be much more careful in their reporting. Now, having said that, John Kerry said the other day, and he's quite correct, that the Democratic members will come back into the fold. Why? Because the party that's out of power finds that its members come back into the fold. So this candidacy is not going to get many Democratic Party votes. Contrary to popular impression, even in the year 2000, and it will be more pronounced, 25% of my votes came from Bush voters, 38% came from Gore voters, and the rest came from people who would never have voted. I think there's going to be lower Democratic votes this year and more from the other sources. Yes, right in back there.
Les Kretman with NBC News. You've characterized many of those who labeled you as possibly being a spoiler as being contemptuous. Why are they contemptuous, and why do you regard yourself as being anything more than having the potential for being a spoiler in this election?
Because they restrict that word to my candidacy. If they called everyone spoilers, because every candidate for political office tries to spoil the prospect of his or her opponents winning, tries to take votes from them, I wouldn't have any problem with it. But the fact that they single out third parties and independent candidates for that term spoiler means that what they're really saying, what their really agenda is that you shouldn't run. You should just sit on the sidelines and watch our country being taken down and taken apart by corporate politics and two parties who are dialing for the same dollars and are converging with more and more similarities towering over the dwindling real differences that they're willing to struggle over. I think those who use the word spoiler need to re-examine their otherwise steadfast commitment to civil liberties, to choice, to freedom. I'm really amused by some of the groups who are pro-choice on the abortion issue are against candidate choice on the ballot. And there will be similar ironies transmitted to their tender conscience in the coming months.
Ralph Nader speaking today at the National Press Club in Washington. Listeners, what do you make of candidate Nader? Could Ralph Nader's candidacy decide who wins the White House in 2004? What's the motivation here? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Bill Schneider, senior political analyst with CNN. Good evening and welcome, Bill. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Glad to be there.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Jack. Hello, friends.
Bill Schneider, take us into this. What's your interpretation of what we've seen in the last 24, 36 hours here? Why is Ralph Nader back in this presidential race?
Well, it's only my reading of his mind and speaking to a couple of people who know him well, and I asked him that question. He seems to believe that the 2000 election gave him clout. He determined the outcome. So this time he thinks Democrats better listen to what he says because he's got the power to make somebody president. And that's what I think is going on here. It's a little more than vanity. It's the sense that he showed he has power, and now they're going to have to listen to him.
In other words, Democrats, bend your agenda to my agenda, or I can deny you the presidency.
Yeah, sure. It's a kind of blackmail. I mean, you know, and he more or less says that. He talks about how, you know, the Democratic Party has lost its way. He wants to pull them back to the left. He argues that, you know, they've gone away. They've strayed away from the true path. And he thinks he's a wake-up call for the Democratic Party.
Jack, what's your reading on Mr. Nader?
Well, you know, 20 years ago or more, David Sanford wrote a book about him called Saint Ralph. And I really think that title catches something essential about him. Righteousness is this man's fuel. And this idea of sort of the lonely, I think just in fact that people like the nation and his erstwhile allies are saying, don't run. I think this makes it all the sweeter for him. It fiddles his self-concept as a kind of ascetic, a saint of politics, a crusader against the, you know, bastions of complacency that surround current politics and corruption.
Bill Schneider, run the numbers for us here. Is Ralph Nader in a position to deny the White House to a Democratic contender?
Sure, if he gets any votes. Last time, I can tell you, I don't know where Mr. Nader's figures were coming from, but I actually checked our 2000 election exit poll, and at least nationwide, we asked the Nader voters who would they have voted for if Ralph Nader's name had mm-hmm. not been on the ballot. 30% of them said they wouldn't have voted for anybody. They would have stayed home. As for the rest, 48% said they would have voted for Gore, 22% for Bush, which means that he took votes at about a rate of 2-1 from Gore rather than Bush. Certainly, there's no one can dispute the fact, and I don't know where Nader's figures came from, he tipped New Hampshire and Florida to Bush because he got many times the number of votes that Bush's margin was over Gore. Bush took both of those states. If he had lost either one, Al Gore would be president. I think it's undeniable that a vote for Nader in 2000 was a vote for Bush.
Now, Bill, last time he had the Green Party and more time behind him, he got on ballots in many states. This time he's an independent. He doesn't have a party supporting him, and he's a bit late in the game. How many states is he likely to show up on the ballot?
Well, he showed up, I think, on 43 last time. He was a write-in candidate in several states. This time it's going to be a little harder because the Green Party has a position in most states. This time he's going to have to gain, in many states, petition signatures, which costs some money that he may not have or want to spend. In some states, local third parties will put his name on the ballot as their candidate if they decide to do so. That'll make it a little bit easier. But it's going to be a struggle, and, you know, one of the things he said in the press conference was a lot of the states around the country are slam dunks for either the Republicans or Democrats. Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll mean anything if he's on the ballot in Texas or in Utah mm-hmm. or even in Hawaii. So he may not even aim to get on the ballot in all 50 states. What he does aim to do very clearly is get into the debates. Now, that's going to be a real struggle. He's going to go to court. He's done that before because he insists on the right to participate in the debates, and the debate commission keeps him out because they say his poll showings aren't strong enough. That's going to be a real confrontation.
One more time with Ralph Nader. We're talking about candidate Nader tonight. You could join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Bob is calling from Chicago. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. I think I've matured a bit in 3 years. I voted for Nader last time, and Illinois was a very safe state for Gore, so I didn't think I had really much to worry about. And I was hoping that the Green Party would get their 5% so they could get matching funds this time. Well, thinking about what happened then and knowing what's happened these past 3 years, and I hope a lot of ex-Nader voters think like I do, there's no way that I would support Nader at all. That helped Bush take the election, and I'm just very disappointed to see that Nader is acting in a way that's, I think, got a big chance of tipping the scales in a Republican favor. So I hope more Nader voters think about what we did last time. Thank you.
Got it, Bob. Thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, let's look just for a minute at Ralph Nader's argument on the merits. He says, we've got one big party here with minor differences, Republican and Democrat. They're both slaves of corporate America, and someone's got to take them on.
Yes, that was a more tenable or at least plausible argument when the Democrats were in power. You know, the last couple of years of the Clinton administration, the campaign finance scandals really were far more serious than anything with Monica Lewinsky. But it's very hard to maintain given the radical turn the Bush administration has taken. Al Gore ran against the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts are simply a dagger drawn to our economic future. Al Gore would never have done the things on the environment that that Bush has done. Al Gore, while the buildup for the war in Iraq was going on, was speaking against the war in Iraq. Al Gore on stem cells, do you think he would have made a Bush's decision? Hardly. So it's just very, very hard to make the case that Bush is somehow going to be running against Bush Light this year. That just isn't so.
And Bill Schneider, what caller Bob says, he voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. There's no way he'll do it in 2004. What do you expect about the turnout that Nader got then and what he might get this fall if he makes it onto some number of ballots?
Well, last time he got 2.7% of the vote nationwide. This time I'd be surprised if he cracked 2%. He might even get 1% because most of his supporters feel exactly the way the caller did. And, in fact, I couldn't find anyone on the progressive or liberal or Democratic side who wanted Ralph Nader to run. There were some people in the White House, like Karl Rove, who I'm sure were cheering him on, but in the ranks of his constituency of progressives, there was not a lot of support for him. Basically, the caller was right. It makes sense to vote for Ralph Nader only if you honestly believe it doesn't matter whether or not President Bush is reelected or whether the Democrats win. Nader was asked about that. Does he believe it matters? And he said he gives the Republican Party a D-minus and the Democrats a D-plus, indicating he doesn't see any real difference between the parties. It doesn't make a lot of difference to him. If you feel that way, go ahead and vote for Nader. But very few people feel that way.
Brian's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't know if I agree or disagree with the last caller. I would not vote for Nader, but I vote for his cause. I vote for his ability to run as a presidential candidate, only because I totally agree with him that there's a duopoly and things like that. And also, you know, that's the American way. He stands up for what America and true democracy should be. He made a point on yesterday's Meet the Press that you would never have this type of thing in Canada, Canadian democracy. And I think, you know, it's corporate power, like he says.
So corporate power, you said you won't vote for him, but you're happy to see him in the arena. We'll see how widespread that view is. Thanks for your call, Brian. Bill is calling from Boston. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to state that I think that the Democrats being concerned about Nader's candidacy should be irrelevant.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if they are so concerned about Ralph Nader taking 1 or 2 or 3% of the vote, then they don't have a lot of confidence in their candidate, do they? I mean, they should be able to put forth a candidate, and so should the Republicans for that matter, that they're confident enough in such that they believe he could beat whoever the challenger
is. Well, that's easy to say, but we all saw what happened last time for both Republican and Democratic candidates. It was a razor-thin thing that took it, wasn't it?
Well, the Republican candidate's kind of set. The Democrats are still choosing their candidate, but maybe they should, maybe both parties should be a little bit more confident in their candidates and confident in the choice they're making, such that they have a candidate that can beat whoever else is in the field. Now, we understand what happened in Florida. You know, I still think there's questions as to whether or not it was 500 or 50, 1,000 votes, because there's a lot of votes that.
But if you'd taken the Nader votes out, it wouldn't even have been close. But we got it, Bill, and our time is short. But I thank you for your call. Bill Schneider, how do you see this unfolding? You say he wants to leverage the Democratic Party to actually change or bend its platform in his direction.
Yes.
And despite what our caller Bill says, we did see how close it was last time. Might he just succeed in getting the Democrats to bend his way?
Well, you know, he had an interesting phrase. He calls his campaign, quote, a national liberation movement for the Democratic Party. A very arresting phrase, but he's obviously trying to influence the Democrats to move in his direction, and maybe he can do that. Because, look, in the end, the Democrats have to be a little bit concerned if the electorate is very evenly divided, as it appears to be. Even if his vote diminishes, then he could make the margin of difference in some key states. There is one calculation you can make that he could actually help the Democrats. For one thing, he may bring out voters who vote for him for president and vote for Democrats for the Congress. He said that today, and that could help the Democrats below the presidential level. In addition, he makes a very potent case against Bush. As one of the callers said, a lot of people agree with him and feel that, you know, Washington is corporate-occupied territory.
Yep.
But in the end, it is likely that Nader's supporters will not vote for him this time for a very simple reason. They know what happened last time. That's the difference between 2004 and 2000. In 2000, a vote for Nader was a vote for Bush. So this time, I think they've learned a lesson and they've wised up.
Well, a cautionary tale there. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you. Ralph Nader standing at the podium, throwing his hat in there once again. The country may hear it differently this year.
May well indeed. I mean, I think this is a test of rationality for his supporters. As Bill said, I mean, they saw what happened. If that hasn't sobered them, then I really think their commitment to the kinds of things Nader says he stands for, that commitment must really be just sheerly verbal.
Verbal, and yet, well, it's a free country. I guess anybody can run for office. And here's one more. Bill Snyder, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Good to have you. Bill Snyder, senior political analyst with CNN. And Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.